Welcome back to The Word at Work. This is the podcast for Christian professionals where we dig into topics to support you in thriving professionally and of greatest importance, living biblically. I'm your host, Miranda Carles. I'm really excited about today's topic and guest, and I think it'll be such a gift to you as you not only stand solid on the truths of the gospel, but also speak wisely and confidently about your faith during your interactions with others. We have Peter Gurry joining us today. Peter is a New Testament professor and director of the Text and Canon Institute at Phoenix Seminary. His work has been published in major academic journals and presented at the Society of Biblical Literature, the Evangelical Theological Society, and the British New Testament Conference. He's also co-author of the book Scribes and Scripture, The Amazing Story of How We Got the Bible. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Miranda.
Yeah, I know you're wrapping up the academic year over there, just wrapped up, so really appreciate you taking some time here at the beginning of summer, and I think I mentioned to you the timing of this interview could not have worked out better, because next week we will have Neil Shenvey joining to discuss why Christianity is a reasonable faith and share evidence for the identity of Jesus as portrayed in the Bible. And so this week we get to discuss why we can trust that Bible that we hold in our hands and have on our bookshelves today. I love that we are having these episodes back to back, and I'm pretty giddy about the conversations, probably more so than I would have been many years ago. And I think a lot of people can relate to this. I very much grew up in a time and place where my faith was not really challenged. I was in rural North Missouri, and being a Christian, well, being a Christian at least by label, even if it ended there, and for many it did, but that was the norm and was widely accepted as reasonable. And then in the last decade, and I know a lot of listeners can relate to this, especially within the workplace and professional contexts, we encounter many more questions and a lot of skepticism about the Christian faith. So I'm just really thankful for folks like yourself and Neil and the many others who put out resources to support that field of Christian apologetics, we'll call it, and combating unbelief in a number of ways. Because with so many things happening in our culture and in our workplaces and even in our churches, sometimes we have to stay anchored to truth and dig into these topics. So really excited about this. Let's chat about the Bible. Peter, you've put a lot of work into equipping others in this area of study. So some listeners might be thinking, okay, sure, we know that Bible scholars and theologians are going to geek out about the history of the Bible, but why would you say it's important for lay Christians, Christians who don't work in vocational ministry, to also have an understanding of how we got the Bible that we use today?
Well, that's a great question. Great place to start. So thanks for having me. I'd say you could give a couple reasons to that. One is just the simplest maybe starting point, and that is this book is the foundation of our faith as Christians. Mm-hmm. And so we ought to know something about where it came from. I think that's sort of just baseline. But even just sort of beyond that can kind of sound like an eat your vegetables answer, you know, just do it because you have to.
Yeah.
But actually, I think there's a lot of good reasons why you should want to. One of them is because it's simply fascinating. The history mm-hmm. of the Bible is a history of a book that has gone through a lot of formats, and it didn't always look the same way it looks to you today. When you crack it open, it has two columns and it has chapters and verses and nice headings. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question as to how did it get to this format? Who added the verse numbers? Who added chapter numbers? Why are the books in the order they are in? Who is responsible for what books we have in the Bible? Those are all really important questions for, I think, any Christian to have some basic sense of. A couple other reasons I could just throw out, and we talk about some more of these in the book, but I think it can be really helpful to making you a better reader of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So I think once you understand more of how we got the Bible, particularly in the format that it's in today, it can help you read it better. So let me just give you a simple answer that listeners are probably familiar with. But if you've been in church very long, at some point you may have heard your pastor say something like, well, I don't really like where the chapter break is here. You know, really, we should read this verse one here with the chapter that goes before, and it makes a lot better sense, or something like that, you know. But the very fact that the Bible comes to us in chapters and verse numbers affects the way we read it, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain verses that could not have been taken out of context as easily as they are today because verse numbers did not exist, right? You might even ask this simple question as when Jesus wants to refer to the account of Moses at the burning bush, when he's talking with the Pharisees, sorry, the Sadducees, and they don't believe in the resurrection, he cannot say to them, haven't you read Exodus chapter 3? Because there is no Exodus chapter 3 in the first century. So instead he says to them, haven't you read the part about the bush? Which makes sense, because then you know exactly which part of the story he's talking about. But it can help make us be better readers of the Bible, I think, once we appreciate something about how we got it. And then last thing I'll say is I think it can serve as a kind of inoculation against skepticism. So we often hear stories of people who didn't know any Christians who didn't know anything about how we got the Bible. And then they came across somebody like Bart Ehrman, or they came across a YouTube video from maybe an atheist or something, and started hearing things they never knew about the history of the Bible. And it can really shake a person's faith, especially a young person's faith, if you don't know anything about how we got it. And so I think it can be really helpful for Christians to hear from other Christians first about the history of the Bible, because I think we can put it in a better, larger context than a skeptic would do.
Yeah, that's so true. Getting that foundation first before we go out into the mess that is social media or just the world today. And that's such a good point. And just being responsible, like you said, responsible students of the Bible. I love how you brought up first, I know you called it the eat your veggies answer, but it's really important, because everything about our faith falls apart if we can't trust the Bible. So,
right.
Really good. Thank you for that. Really good things for us to think about as we, I think a lot of people listening in maybe haven't thought about this a lot, or maybe grew up like I did and just the Bible was true because it was. And so this is really important, I think, for us to be digging into today. And as we head into some of the cultural shifts that we are seeing, the origin story is perhaps the most critical origin story for us to understand, because it falls apart after that. Well, you are the director at, or co-director, right, with John at the Text and Canon Institute.
That's right. Yep.
And yeah, the word canon might be a word that you probably use more than the average person. Some listeners might not be familiar with the canonization of the Bible. Can you tell us just a little bit about what that means, what that process is, and how we can trust that the right pieces were included in the Bible we have today?
Yeah, sure. So it's sort of the basic level thing that canon means, which books belong in the Bible. Listeners probably have heard the term canon. You might think of something, the Western canon of literature, you know, means something like, what are the great books or stories that belong, that have formed us as people? Or you might think, if you're a big Star Wars fan, you might think of like, what belongs in the Star Wars canon, you know, which movie or TV show spinoff is like official, you know?
My like, husband would have a lot of thoughts. I'm kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah. Or like, you know, Marvel movies, like same kind of thing. It's sort of like when you think about a world, creative world, what are the things that define what belongs in that world and what doesn't? And you might think of the Bible in a similar way. It's obviously not the same, but in a similar way, the canon is are those books that determine what we should and shouldn't believe as Christians. So books that are outside the canon, for example, can be really important and really valuable. As Protestants, a book like Pilgrim's Progress has been hugely influential to us, and a really great book. And many of us hold it up as tremendously important and valuable, but we would not base our theology on it. We wouldn't cite it as proof of something that we believe, you know, in the way we would the book of Romans, of course. So the canon very simply is that list of books that Christians hold as authoritative, and in particular, authoritative in a way that no other book is. So these are the books that have authority over everything else. All right. And in simple terms, we have the Old Testament canon and the New Testament canon. Okay. And in short, this is the very, very short version, Miranda. Okay. My colleague John is the expert on canon. So if he listens to this, he's gonna have to come talk to me later for how much I'm simplifying this story. But the short version is Protestants adopted the same books of the Old Testament that were used in among Jews around the time of the first century, so around the time of Jesus. Okay, so the books that the Jewish synagogue adopted, Protestants adopted that as well. Whereas Roman Catholics and then Eastern Orthodox adopted a wider canon, which includes what we typically call the Apocrypha. So that includes books like Tobit. It also includes additions to some books, like additions to the book of Esther and Daniel. And then when it comes to the New Testament, pretty much the three major branches of Christianity, Eastern Orthodoxy, Protestantism, and Roman Catholicism, all have the same 27 books in the New Testament. And that base the basic criterion for the New Testament books was was a book written by an apostle or a close associate of an apostle. Okay, so in other words, the book had to have apostolic authority attached to it. There were other books that the early church really, really liked. There's a book called The Shepherd of Hermas that listeners are probably not very familiar with. Frankly, I find it a bit strange and hard to understand, but they loved it. But they were very clear that it was written too late to be written by an apostle or his close associate. And so they rejected it. Okay. Other books, like the Gospel of Thomas, that listeners may have heard of, were also written late, but also they never believed were associated with an apostle. And so that one lost out both basically on two counts. But that's the basic, I think, if you boil it down to one single criterion, and there were other criteria they sort of added to that to try to discern whether a book was written by an apostle or a close associate. But that was the basic one that sort of was the great divider. It's why we have four gospels, not more, not less, right? It's not as if to say there's some magical reason why we have to have four, although some early theologians kind of tried to think through the number four and its significance. But it was basically these are the four that are attached to an apostle or a close associate of apostle, and all the other gospel literature that was written in the second century and later, none of them were credible in that regard, and so they were excluded. So that's the basic point. Now, in terms of the Old Testament canon, really in the New Testament as well, this took time to recognize these books. Okay, so not every book was sort of immediately recognized without any difficulty. There was kind of with the case of the Old Testament, there's very much a core of the Old Testament by the time we get to the New Testament period. But there was still some debate among even Jews about books like Esther, because it didn't mention the name of God, for example, or Song of Solomon or Ecclesiastes. For the New Testament, there were some doubts early on about some of the smaller books like 2nd and 3rd John, 2nd Peter, for example. And then there were some doubts about books like Revelation and certain parts of Christianity. The four gospels were pretty much recognized right away. The letters of Paul were recognized very early as well. What we call the larger Catholic epistles, so James, 1 Peter, 1 John, were all accepted fairly early. But by about the 4th century, we have a firm, what we could call a core canon, certainly for the Old Testament, although there's debates about that up until the time of the Reformation. And then the New Testament is pretty much set by the 4th century as well. All right, so again, that's a lot, I realize. But
No,
that's the
that's good.
short
I think
version.
it's fascinating because again, I don't think it's something that a lot of us and a lot of listeners have thought through a lot or know a lot about. Can you share with folks a little bit more about who the individuals were that were involved in that process throughout history, who would have had authority to do that? Because I think there's this interesting thing that I don't know if people bring up questions about this, but reconciling like this is the word of God, but also the men that he or the people that he used throughout history to bring it to what it is today.
It's a great question. So I think as Protestants, we think that the church recognizes the authority of the the canonical books, and that sets us apart from the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church would tend to answer that question differently and say something like, actually, the church determines the Bible. So the church has a kind of authority over the Bible, whereas as Protestants, we're quite the opposite. We say that the authority the church has actually derives from the Bible. And what we do as Christians is recognize its authority. We don't sort of in any way determine it or make it so. Okay. But in terms of an individual, there really is no particular individual. And honestly, sometimes probably the most common misconception about the canon is that it was decided by a church council. And usually, sort of in the popular imagination, people tie that to the Council of Nicaea in 325. And that's partly because it was popularized by the Da Vinci Code. But I think it sticks in people's mind. It sticks in people's mind because it gives a simple explanation. And it's like, well, there had to be just like one group of people that just decided it for everybody. Because otherwise, how did people come to agree on it? And actually, that's just not the case. You can't point to a single church council or even a single church figure Like, you know, one really important theologian who decided it for everybody else. Now, rather, what you have is Christian theologians talking about it and eventually coming to a consensus and all agreeing on the same set of books. Now, again, we got to make a distinction with the Old Testament because there was disagreement or it wasn't quite clear for throughout the Middle Ages in terms of what to do with the Apocrypha. And the basic question there was, should the Christian church adopt the Old Testament of the synagogue of Judaism, or should it use a more expanded set of books than what Judaism used? And this is where Protestants and Catholics diverged in the Reformation. But what's important for listeners to know about even that is that there was no settled agreement by the time of the Reformation. In other words, you cannot say that the Protestants innovated. Our earliest Christian lists of the Old Testament canon actually agree with the Protestant list, not with the Catholic list. So in terms of precedent, you might say, Protestants actually have the earlier precedent as far as the record goes, historical record goes. But yeah, there was no single individual. Now, there are some key figures along the way, like Athanasius writes a very famous letter about Easter, because the date of Easter moves around, and so they had to sort that issue out in the early church period. And Athanasius is a key figure. He's kind of the first one that gives us our complete list that matches Old and New Testament. But he's anticipating other people. It's not like he comes up with this out of the blue, right? He thinks he's just passing on what kind of everybody agrees on at that point. One of the simplest ways to see this is in what's called the canon lists. And these are lists of books that various Christian figures from, say, Origen, who's an important second and third century church father, Melito of Sardis is another name, lots of names that are probably unfamiliar to most listeners, but they're important early church figures who at various times and in various writings of theirs wrote down these lists of what they thought were, what they held to be, and what they thought other Christians held to be, those books that belonged in the Bible. And so you can go through and actually sort of chart that over time and see the agreement sort of coalesce. But yeah, it's hard because there is no single event and there's no single figure that decides it. And I think actually one of the reasons why in the popular imagination a lot of people think that there was is because it makes for a much simpler explanation. Whereas actually as Christians, I think we can look at it and say, no, we can actually see the Holy Spirit working through the larger, you know, through Christians as a whole, not through one single individual who just declares it from on high and says, now this is the Bible. Rather, it's a work of God's people over time and in different places. And I actually think as a Christian, that's one of the things that gives me confidence that we have the right books that we do is precisely because it wasn't just some one individual. Even we, I was like, we always like to give the example of Luther in this regard. So that when Luther comes along, Luther's not a huge fan of the book of James. And in his own translation of the Bible, at least of the New Testament, he takes four books and marks them off separately and puts them at the end. James, 2 Peter, Jude, and Revelation. He numbers all the other New Testament books, but then he doesn't give numbers to those ones. So they're sort of like almost tacked on at the end. And famously, he said at one point around the dinner table, he said, you know, he thought that James was an epistle of straw. So he was not a big fan of it. Okay. But even a person as important as Luther was to the Reformation could not remove a book like James from the Bible because the rest of Christians looked at it and went, no, Luther can have this opinion, but he's wrong. And James belongs in the Bible, and it belongs right there alongside Paul. And we have to read him together with Paul. And so it's a, I think it's Luther's treatment of James is a great example of the way even a figure as sort of charismatic as Luther, and by that I just mean, you know, important and influential as Luther, cannot decide the matter for everybody. And so I think in my mind it gives us even greater confidence in the results,
Yeah, absolutely.
the
The
process.
complexity really highlights God's hand in it, that it wasn't just one person saying this is what it is, or one small committee, but for it to, take that journey through that span of time and become what we see today. That's really helpful, I'm sure. And I know a lot of this, I've read your book, and I just it's fascinating, a lot of things that I hadn't known or thought about before, and we'll talk about your book more in a little bit. But I think that's really helpful, and thanks for unpacking that for us. I want to switch gears just a little bit. Beyond just trusting the Bible in general, we also have decisions around which version to purchase. This is kind of a practical question. Or what do we read for our daily reading time? What do we buy a family member as a gift? It can be overwhelming to select a Bible. And a lot of people raise skeptical questions about just the fact that we have so many various translations of the Bible in existence today. So I guess question, why are there so many translations? And then how do you recommend someone go about selecting the primary translation that they'll use for their personal study time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I love that way of asking it really gets to the, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road on this question, right? Is like at some point I've got to actually buy a translation and read it, hopefully. And you know, I always start by saying the best translation is the one you read. Because the worst one is one that just sits on the shelf. And thankfully today we are blessed with an abundance of really good English translations of the Bible. And so I think one of the first things I want to say to listeners is don't be paralyzed by the choice. And I think a lot of times because we have so many choices, we actually put more pressure on the decision than it needs to have. Okay. Now, I don't want to downplay it. It's an important question, and having a good translation is important. But I guess what I'm trying to say is if you pick a mainstream evangelical translation, so here I'll just kind of name the mainstream one, something like the NASB, the NIV, the ESV. Let's see, what am I missing? Even the New King James, I'll even throw that one in there. Okay. They're all good translations. All of them are going to serve you really, really well if you read them well. Right. So I, you know, I kind of liken the pressure that people feel to get the their Bible translation right the way I feel when I go to the grocery store and my wife sends me there to get, like, you know, spaghetti sauce.
Right.
It all seems like fine, like, oh, just go to the store and get spaghetti sauce for me, until I go in the aisle and I'm faced with like 30 options and I'm like, oh gosh, I don't know. Now I'm gonna get the wrong one, you know? And I love, when we lived in England during my PhD, it was so much easier because the closest grocery store was like this hole in the wall. It was like the size of my kitchen, honestly. And they have this like one thing of everything.
Yeah.
So if you like wanted cereal, literally they had like two kinds of cereal. So like if I went to get cereal for the kids, it was so easy because I had no choice to make. But as soon as you're faced with a choice of like more than 10, okay, it can be paralyzing.
Yeah.
That's how people often feel about translations. And I just want to say right off the bat, you don't need to feel that way. You should rather relieve yourself and feel like, you know what, any brand name spaghetti sauce you get is going to be just fine for dinner. And in the same way, pretty much any mainstream evangelical translation is going to serve you really well if you read it, right? If you read it and if you read it well. But that said, there are obviously differences between them, okay? And the basic difference between them that most people find helpful is to think of the spectrum between the more literal and more paraphrastic, okay? And this is a spectrum that goes all the way back to antiquity. Okay, we can find this in the early translations of the Old Testament into Greek, show this a similar spectrum. But on the far end of something really literal, you have something like the Old King James or the NASB. The ESV is on that side as well. On the spectrum of paraphrase, the farthest end of the paraphrase, you have something like the Message, or a little bit less paraphrastic, but still on that end would be something like the New Living Translation. Okay, and then somewhere in the middle, you might say, would be like the NIV, okay? The New International Version. And basically what it comes down to is decisions like how much does the translator want to help the modern reader? Okay. How much do they want to take metaphors from the Old Testament world, say, and put them into some more contemporary English? Or how much, essentially, how much work do they want to make you as the reader do to understand it? So let me give you an example, because this goes way beyond just picking the right English word for a given Hebrew or Greek word in the original. It's all sorts of cultural things. For example, what is a Leviathan? And when was the last time you met one?
No idea.
Right? I mean, asking the question like that makes it very clear you have no idea. I have no idea. Like, we don't have Leviathans today as far as we know. Maybe we do, but the point is we don't know as soon as I use that word Leviathan. So a more literal translation might try to keep the word Leviathan, which has been in English now for quite a while, and then make you as the English reader figure out what that probably means. But it sort of intentionally makes the word foreign to you, because it is foreign. But something like the New Living Translation might try to translate that, if I can use that term, depending on how the translators interpret it. They might think it's something like a rhinoceros, or they might think it's something like a mythical creature that doesn't actually exist, but that was in sort of the thought world of the ancient people. And so they might try to translate it like that. Or another way to think about this is terms for money, which are very culturally specific. Okay. How much is a denarius? And what can you buy with it? I don't know, because I don't have it. I haven't bought anything in my entire life with a denarius, so I don't know. So a translator has to decide, what are they going to do in a parable like the parable of the unforgiving servant, where the money that's owed, remember, the first servant owes a ton of money to his master, and then he has a fellow servant who owes him a lot less. Well, how should a translator handle that? Should they keep it in the terms of sort of the Greek and say things like he owed 10,000 talents, which then doesn't mean anything other than 10,000 of something? So something like the New Living Translation might say he owed his master millions and millions of dollars, right? Now, the problem is, as soon as they say dollars, that translation cannot be used outside of the United States.
Right.
So they now got to think, if we're going to sell this Bible translation in Britain, we've got to change that to pounds. So that's what I mean by saying there's translators face a whole host of decisions. And I like to say the basic question that a translator faces is, how much does the translator want to bring the world of the Bible into our modern world through the translation and say things like millions and millions of dollars? Okay. Or how much do they want to force us as the reader to have to go back into the world of the Bible and say something like 10,000 talents? And then we as the reader have a bit more work to do to figure out what that most likely means. Okay. So that's another way to think of that general spectrum. Something like the New King James or the ESV is going to do less of that. They're going to require more of the reader for us to go back into the world of the Bible to understand it. Whereas something like the New Living Translation is going to do a lot more of bringing the world of the Bible into our world today. Now, because that involves interpretation, that's where things get controversial, right? Because translation always involves interpretation. So something like the New Living Translation, you could argue, is doing more interpretation for the reader than something like the ESV or the New King James. Okay, so that's I still have not answered your question. You've probably noticed.
You're hesitant to recommend one.
Because,
yeah.
Well, because I want people to know what they're deciding.
Yeah.
I want them to know what they're buying when they go out and buy. So I think the first question to ask, actually, when you think about what Bible translation to buy, is who's it for? Who's it for? So when my daughters, who are now, 9 and 12, when I got them their first translation, I bought them a little-known translation called not the NIV, but the NIRV, which stands for New International Reader's Version. And basically what they did is the NIV was so popular when it first came out, they actually thought, hey, we can do even better. The original one is aimed at about a seventh grade reading level. They said, why don't we do a revision aimed at a third grade reading level? And we'll design it specifically for people who aren't very good with the English language. Maybe they're learning English as a second language, or they're really young, right? So they did things like they took all the sentences and tried to make them even shorter and use smaller words. So like Psalm 23, instead of he makes me lie down in green pastures, is he's something like he makes me lie down in green grass. Which, I mean, Miranda, for those of us that grew up in churches, like, that's horrible. the shepherd does not make me lie down in green grass. He makes me lie down in green pastures.
Right.
Like, it has to be pastures. But
it's so helpful for your daughter.
But so helpful for my daughter, who's at a third grade reading level.
Yeah.
Now, the problem was she grew out of it really quickly, right? So then I moved her on to the NIV, But that's the way to think about it, is who's your audience. I think for somebody who's never read the Bible, something like the New Living Translation can be super helpful to them. Where otherwise there's so much technical language. Now, what I like to say is I think a Christian should, as they mature in their faith, try to also mature to a more literal translation as well. The one that does less interpretation for them. And does less to sort of remove some of the metaphorical language that's just all through the Bible, because sometimes those idioms are really important, and also they connect us with the past in a way. I think a translation like the New Living Translation tends to kind of, it's kind of, we sometimes use the language of Christianese, but I think there can be real value in Christianese, in sort of something like take for instance. If something like the New Living Translation takes out the word justification, okay, That could be really helpful for a new Christian who does not know what that technical theological term means. It can be much more helpful to just say, declared them to be in good standing with God or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But I also think there's something really valuable and really important for a Christian as they mature their faith to say, no, I actually know the theological term justification and know what it means. Because Christians and Protestants in particular, but I mean, certainly Christians as a whole, have used this term forever, you know? And so actually, I want to know the term because that one term brings with it of the whole of this really important doctrine, you know? And so I think there's something lost when we move away from those theological terms. But again, for somebody who's brand new to the faith, you want to help them ease into that. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
So that's
absolutely.
kind of the way I try to think of it, Brandon. Is I say, if you're a new Christian, I aim for something like the New Living Translation and start there. But then I would aim to go beyond it. Now, the other thing I would say is try to make one translation your sort of reference point. Okay, so as you're growing in your faith, I think, you know, try to move to a more literal translation if you can, and then make that sort of, I would call it, your base of operations. Meaning that's what you do your daily Bible reading out of. It's maybe what you do Bible memorization out of. Okay. And then you can supplement that with other translations. That's the great thing about having, you know, more than one is you can compare them. And you can
Yeah.
see where the New Living Translation is being more interpretive than something like the NASB. But
Yep.
also, you know, sometimes the NASB can be just obtuse to think of, you know, it's just really hard to understand sometimes because it's so awkward in English, frankly. I stopped using it for that reason in my own Bible read because it just was so awkward sometimes.
Yeah.
But try to have a kind of a base of operations, and then but then okay, I'm going to throw one more wrench in this. Okay, so but now at this point, your listeners are like, wow, he really does not want to answer this question. But no, I would say there's also real value if you do a yearly Bible reading plan, which I highly recommend. From time to time, switch it up. So let's say, for example, let's say you are a mature Christian, okay, and you've grown up on, maybe you grew up on the NIV, let's say, okay. All right, great. You're really familiar with it. So this year, switch. Do your Bible reading plan out of the New King James, for say, or the ESV, okay? Or on the other hand, if you grew up on the King James or the New King James, switch this year to the New Living Translation. Okay? Just to kind of re-energize your Bible reading. And you will see things you did not notice before because of the familiarity of your old translation. Okay. Now, as I said, kind of keep the other one as your base. Maybe you're still memorizing out of the other one, but you're reading this other one to give you a new perspective, maybe. Does that make sense? I know that's a lot.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Very practical, and I think to your point, there's a lot of learning that can happen when we encounter those parts that they don't make sense and popping open another translation. I use the ESV for many years. I've used the ESV as my primary, like my Bible that I read and study but I have other versions, and sometimes I'll encounter something, and just the way something's phrased, like what does this mean? And then
Exactly. It's like,
popping open either a trusted commentary or going back to and looking at other versions and what they say, and it can really help. I love that idea of like switching it up for for a whole year for your reading plan. I think that's really good. All right, thank you. For that, I think that's practical and helpful, and no need to give a straight answer because I think that helps people understand kind of the context around why the different versions exist, and knowing where they fall on the spectrum.
The other thing I should mention, Miranda, is just I think it's important to say for listeners, again, because the many options we have today can be paralyzing, it's really important to see that also as a benefit because we have a tremendous heritage in English. I'm pretty convinced that in English we have one of the richest, if not the richest, heritage of Bible translation in the world. Meaning it goes all the way back to the 14th century with Wycliffe, but Wycliffe is translating from Latin, not from Greek and Hebrew. But by the time of William Tyndale in the 16th century, all major English translations, certainly the Protestant ones, are from Greek and Hebrew, and they build on each other. And we this means we have hundreds and hundreds of years of history when you crack open your English Bible that your translation is based on. Like, no, you know, every translation, even a fresh one where they go back to the Greek and Hebrew and they're not just revising a previous one, which is the normal way to do a new translation, they're still aware of how other translations have handled difficult issues. And so, you know, we've had a long time to try to think about how to resolve some of the difficulties that we deal with when we read the original languages. You know, Greek and Hebrew are sometimes they're much clearer than what's in English, but they're not always. Sometimes they have ambiguity, or sometimes, you know, the interpretation is difficult. But we've had a long time to, it's not the right word, but to test options out, if I can put it that way. So just, I think, you know, the one thing I always want to leave people with when I talk about translation is the question of which one is best is not unimportant, but put it in the context of a deep appreciation for the fact that you have a choice to make at all. That's really something that we should not take for granted as English speakers. We have a tremendously rich heritage to be thankful for. So sorry, I just felt like I needed to get that out there.
No, that's good. That's good. I think this is really practical for people, whether they're deciding which of the many options off their bookshelf. I feel like a lot of Christians today, we've got, you know, five or six translations just on our bookshelf or in our cabinets at home. And so that's very helpful, whether you're buying a new Bible or deciding which one to use during your study time. And then I want to go back to this idea of skepticism around the Bible and if we can trust it, because I do think we will continue to face more and more of this, it seems like. And so I'm curious, Peter, from your point of view, what are some of the biggest objections that you see raised against the reliability of the Bible?
Yeah, I think a common one is this idea that because the Bible has a history, therefore we can't trust it, or it doesn't even make sense to talk about the Bible. So because, you know, different branches of Christianity disagree on which books to include, or because there are different translations, or because there are, you know, differences between our manuscripts behind our translations, therefore we really don't have the Bible. What we really just have are Bibles, plural, and there's so much disparity between them that we could never really think that this, that the Bible could be any kind of foundation for the way that we live. So, and I think that's a bit of a shift. I think it used to be that skeptics would say things like, you can't trust the Bible because of the history is not accurate enough, or because it talks about miracles. And I think today there's a bit of a shift to thinking, well, you can't trust the Bible because there really is no Bible at all. There's just Bibles, plural. And I think, you know, I think there's, on one hand, it's certainly true that the Bible has a history. It has not always looked the same as it does to us today. And it is certainly true that our manuscripts behind our English translations do not all agree at all points. Because copying, for the simple reason that copying by hand is pretty difficult and time consuming. But I think it's a big mistake to conclude from the history of the Bible that we cannot trust it and that we can't build our lives on it. In fact, I think when you look at the history of the Bible, it's pretty remarkable how much consistency there is over time and how much the message shines through the same, whether you are, for example, reading it in a medieval Hebrew manuscript, okay, or whether you are reading it in Latin in that same period of history, okay, in Latin translation, or whether you're reading it like we are today in an English translation. I think actually the message is remarkably stable over time, and that's a tremendous reason to have confidence in it and to continue to trust this book. I mean, the other thing I could add is that today our Bibles are based on so much more information and knowledge than probably at any time in history. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that aside from the first readers of the first copies of, say, the New Testament, we stand in a more privileged position relative to our copies of the Bible than almost anybody in history has. So, yeah, the knowledge of that history raises some questions that we talk about in the book for sure. But I actually think it's kind of, put it this way, I think the history of the Bible is one of the worst reasons for being skeptical about the Christian faith. Like, I think there are much bigger, I think there are more difficult problems. I think something like the problem of evil is a bigger one. Now, maybe that's because I spend most of my time thinking about this particular one, and so I've sorted out the difficulties to my own satisfaction.
Sure.
And I'm more familiar with it. But I just, the more time I spend in my particular area, spending time with the New Testament manuscripts, the more I think that's a really bad, that's a really lousy reason to be skeptical about the Christian faith. We have tremendous grounds for confidence that what we're reading in our English translations reflects really closely and really well what the apostles wrote. There are places of doubt for sure. There's still, I'm writing a commentary right now on the book of Jude, and Jude has a couple of really difficult textual problems. But neither of them are things like, well, it's a choice between Christian orthodoxy and Christian heresy. Do you know what I mean? It's like, is it this theologically true reading, or is it this other theologically true reading? And so at the level of Christian doctrine, it's like there's really hardly an issue at all here. There's no issue. So, but yeah, I think you're right. I think it will continue to be an issue. I think it'll be more of an issue in the coming months, particularly as Christian morality is less and less popular. I think these other issues will become more of a way, a kind of a gotcha. Like, we already know the skeptical attitude will kind of be, we already know you're wrong because of your morals, but we also now know you're stupid because of, like, I just saw it on Twitter the other day, because the Bible came down to us like the telephone game, and English translation history is like the telephone game.
Yeah.
So,
And those
and
things
that's
can be
like,
really jarring if
yeah, it can be
you,
really jarring.
yeah,
Exactly.
if you
And actually,
haven't.
if you don't know it, and it's like the truth is really quite the opposite. Like, the history of English translation is a history of remarkable, or I would describe it as increasing fidelity. Like, it's gotten better over time, actually. So it's not at all like the telephone game. But yeah, but I think that's, again, I think is one of the reasons why it's important for Christians to know something about the history of how we got this book, because it will be used against us if we don't. We don't know our own history. And it look, it's our it this is our heritage, right? I think skeptics are right if they call us out on our ignorance on this stuff. Like, if we make the claim that this book is from God is not a small claim. Like, let's own up to that and say, no, that's actually, you're right. That is a pretty startling claim to say that a book written a long time ago by a whole bunch of different people in a different language could somehow be the thing that I should base my life on now in the 21st century. That's a pretty big claim. So let's own it, and then let's do the work of saying, yeah, and we more than anybody else know how we got this book, and we are sort of, I like to think that we are the custodians of the Bible. We should be. It's our book, right? Now, it's a public book, so anybody can read it, and the history is public, and that's one of the things that marks our faith off, is that we're a historical faith, right? Our faith is not based on some private experience that our founder had, like something like Mormonism is, it's public. So it's open to public scrutiny. So I say, one of the reasons why we deal with so much history in the book is because we want to say, this is public knowledge. We have colleagues in our discipline that do not come to the same conclusions that we do on this stuff. We know that. But the evidence is there, and we may have a different interpretation of it, okay? But let's make the case for it. But as Christians, it's like, this is our heritage. This is our book. So let's own it. And that's a lot of what we do at the Texan Canon Institute here at the seminary, is trying to do both research on the history of the Bible, really good academic research on the history of the Bible, but then, especially through articles on our website and then through this book, make that accessible to Christians so they can appreciate better how rich of a history we have, and just how great our heritage is as Christians. We have, when you think about somebody like William Tyndale giving his life so that we can have the Bible in English, I don't know how you can be indifferent to that if you're a Christian after hearing that story. This is phenomenal. So one of the things I really want to leave people with when it comes to the history of the Bible is we have so much to be thankful for and to appreciate. The fact that you have a Bible you can open, that really is very readable. It may be hard to, I know when you get to Leviticus, it's tricky. Okay. I know Revelation's a bit weird, but like, truly, like, so much has gone into you being able to do that, to just open a Bible and have such easy access to it, that let's not take it for granted. Let's be people of the book and read it and live it.
That's so good. And I would just like to encourage anyone listening in, if this is new to you and something you haven't thought much about, I know my experience has been a few years ago when I started digging into a few more I guess, apologetic type books and studies, that it has been incredibly encouraging and fortifying for my own faith. And it's helped me to navigate conversations more confidently with skeptics. So I will link, Peter, to the book that you and John wrote, Scribes and Scripture, and also to Text and Canon Institute. Are there any other resources you'd like to direct folks to if they'd like to learn more about the history of the Bible, or would most things be routed through the TCI website?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best single stop to go. And then from there, you can there's lots of digging you can do. And in the book, yeah, at the end of each chapter, we have a further reading section. So if you mm-hmm. really want to dive deeper, and that's another thing we say in the book, is one of the reasons we wrote it was to inspire curiosity. Like mm-hmm. we, John and I, do this because we kind of got sucked into it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. That's good.
It just is like so fascinating. Uh-huh. We love it. Like, it's just, once you start thinking about manuscripts and the canon and Bible translation, it's just kind of, for some of us, we catch the bug. So fair yeah. warning to some of your listeners, you may catch the bug on this. Okay. Yes. Others of you will just read the book or a few articles and you'll be satisfied. But there are a few of you listening who will catch the bug. So, yeah. But I'm warning you ahead of time.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for the work you do. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the Christian professionals who are listening in today?
No, just that I hope that they, you know, continue to read the Bible and try to live it out. You know, that's the end goal, is we should be, we're just so thankful that God has revealed himself in the written word to tell us about his great acts in history, and especially to tell us what they mean, to tell us their significance. Mm-hmm. And it's that significance that we want to try to bring to bear in all of our life. And that certainly includes our work.
Mm, good. Well, thank you, Peter, so much for joining us today. It's been such a treat to hear from you about this. And I know it'll be valuable to everyone listening in.
Great. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Miranda.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Word at Work. If you enjoy this podcast or get something good out of it, be sure to like, subscribe, and the biggest compliment you can give us is to share this episode with friends. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and we will see you next time.